I was reading, just regarding the Ten Commandments, that up until, I suppose, the last 50 years, the Ten Commandments have been cherished in every era of the church. I was reading Martin Luther, the great reformer, 500 years ago, and he wrote, "I recite the Ten Commandments every night, word for word, like a child." And John Calvin, the father of the Reformed tradition, he called the Ten Commandments a summary of God's moral law. So the Ten Commandments, up until 50 years ago, has been cherished. But I think it's fair to say that today in the church, the Ten Commandments don't get a lot of attention. And I've been thinking about why, and I think it's probably because they don't seem relevant to the Christian life today. I mean, thou shalt not murder. I don't murder. Thou shalt not steal. I haven't stolen. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Well, I hope I don't. And so we think to ourselves, aren't the Ten Commandments really for the very wicked? Aren't they for criminals and to restrain those extreme forms of behavior? But they don't seem to speak into my Christian life very much at all. And so they've faded in the Christian tradition, for sure. And I think if we were to think about what's happened in terms of the Ten Commandments, we'd say this, that the way the Ten Commandments has been interpreted in the last 50 years has been individualistically. In other words, am I a murderer? Am I a thief? Am I an adulterer? And that's interesting because up until 50 years ago, in the creeds of the church, and I think in their original context, the Ten Commandments, we'll see, aren't just individualistic. And I think that, in my opinion, recovering the Ten Commandments will equip the church to address the pressing issues of 2013, including issues of justice, because, interestingly, the Ten Commandments originally, in their original context, as you'll see, were a platform for justice. And understood properly, they'll be a platform for justice again today. And I think particularly for our purposes in this series, they touch very closely on themes related to indigenous settler relations that we're talking about. But to understand this, you've got to understand the background of the Ten Commandments. Let me explain. Here we are at Sinai, right? God descends on the mountain, and Moses receives these two stone tablets. But you've got to remember that the nation, we're the nation of Israel here at the foot of Sinai. Just 50 days ago, we were in Egypt as slaves. We've only just crossed the Red Sea. And the point is that as we're hearing these Ten Commandments, the scars from the Egyptian whip are still raw on our backs. They're still weeping. Slavery is so recent. And so as we hear these words, it's slavery that's not just in our memory, it's in our skin. This is the context of the Ten Commandments. And you remember the story there in the opening chapters of Exodus, Exodus chapter 1 mainly, where the Egyptians were a slave nation, the Israelites were a slave nation in Egypt, and they were the workers that built the store cities for Pharaoh of Pithom and Ramesses. And they really worked, they labored in the brick factories of Pharaoh to build these store cities. And what happened in this oppression, it amounted to genocide. You remember how a whole generation of male babies were killed, and that's no children's story. And you remember the story when Moses, who was a Hebrew but also an Egyptian prince, intervened when a Hebrew slave was being beaten. And that's no children's story. And one of the horrific moments in these opening chapters of Exodus that is part of the background to the Ten Commandments is in Exodus chapter 5. And it's this chilling moment where the Hebrew foremen, who are particularly vulnerable, they're not meeting their quotas of bricks. And they said, they went to Pharaoh and they said, "We're dying here," in Exodus chapter 5. "Can you please reduce the quotas of bricks?" And then there's this chilling moment that reminds me of the stories of North Korean labor camps in verse 19 of Exodus chapter 5, where Pharaoh says, "No, we won't reduce the quota, but But you have to get the straw yourself. And it's crystal clear that the Israelites are being deliberately worked to death. This is genocide. And chapter 5, verse 19, there's this chilling moment. The foreman of the people of Israel saw that they were in trouble when they said, "You may by no means reduce your number of bricks, your daily task each day." And lives, Israelite lives at least, were expendable in the economic expansion of Pharaoh. And really, economic productivity was God. And so God strategically places one Hebrew, Moses, in the courts of Egypt. And he becomes a son of the daughter of Pharaoh. And Moses is raised as an Egyptian with all the diplomacy of an Egyptian. And then one day, this educated and equipped leader, Moses, sees a burning bush. And God says to him in Exodus chapter 3, now listen to these words that God says to Moses. They're very significant. "I have seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. And I've come down to rescue them from the hands of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey." And if you just notice some of those words, the misery and the crying out and the suffering, this is a very important background for the Ten Commandments. And you know the story now of the plagues and then that final Passover and then that crossing over the Red Sea and that journey to Sinai. And now here at the foot of Sinai, we stand to receive these 10 words from Yahweh, the God of Israel. And Moses receives 2 stones with 5 commandments written on each, probably. I would hold up the 2 stones, but I can't because I've got a handheld mic. And here the first 5 stones represent Israel's relationship with Yahweh. Don't use my name in vain. Don't have any other gods before me. And then the second set of 5 commands in particular concern Israel's relationship to other people and to one another, relationship between humankind. There's some crossover, but that's basically how the 2 stones work. These 10 words. And what we'll see as we come to study these 10 commands, that God is forming a society that is not a society of economic expansion at any cost, and not a society of murder and of whips, but a society of mutual care, where everyone, especially the most vulnerable, can thrive. It's an extraordinary thing, these 10 commandments. We only have time to get into 3 of them, unfortunately, today, but that'll do to make our point. And we're really going to focus on this second stone, and that means we're focusing on relationship between humanity and not so much focusing right now on those commands to do with our relationship with God. Well, I want to first of all go to the 4th command. Would you just please open up Deuteronomy chapter 5, and I just want to read these words here at the 4th command, the Sabbath command. And if you just do open up, because it's very, very significant. This is very, very significant stuff. Deuteronomy 5, you probably know, and I'll just note, you might want to jot it down, that the 10 Commandments is also found in Exodus chapter 20, and it's found in Deuteronomy chapter 5 as a second occurrence, and I'll read from verse 12. "Observe the Sabbath day. Here's the 4th command, to keep it holy as the Lord commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do your work, but on the 7th day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God." Now, I'm just going to note here that in ancient Near Eastern law codes, and we've got heaps of laws that come from this period of history, there's no such thing as a day of rest. This is unique to Israel. It's remarkable. "On the 7th day of the Sabbath to the Lord your God," and this is the most remarkable thing, "on it you shall not do any work, you, your son, or your daughter." That's not surprising, but watch this. "Your male servant or your female servant," that's a surprise. "Your ox or your donkey or any of your livestock," that's a surprise. "Or the sojourner / alien / stranger, refugee, who is within your gates, that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you." Now see the reason here, verse 15, you'll see why I spoke about Egypt. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, because of that rescue, the Lord your God has commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. And the point we want to make here, I think, is that no one in Egypt had a Sabbath rest, especially Israelites. The brick factories of Pharaoh didn't stop for weekends. They didn't stop. But God says, remember the Sabbath day, you and your slaves. So an Israelite wasn't to work on the Sabbath. Their animals weren't to work on the Sabbath. Their slaves even weren't to work on the Sabbath. And this is absolutely extraordinary. A weekly day of rest proclaimed. Now just think of this now. Here's Israel standing at Sinai. Just picture this again. Imagine how you'd feel. You're a slave nation. A weekly day of rest proclaimed for a nation of slaves. What a relief. If a person is to thrive, life needs to consist of more than work. We need space to rest and play. And from today in Israel, no one, not even the animals, are to be deprived of this rhythm of work and rest. Work and rest. Work and rest. So this Sabbath command, it injects a life-giving pause into the endless cycle of production. And it's part of the rhythm of the created order. Life works best that way. You remember Genesis 1 and 2. 6 days God created the world, and then he rested. Work and rest. Work and rest. And in Exodus chapter 20, in the Ten Commandments there, that's exactly how the Sabbath command is treated. It says, have a Sabbath, because God created for 6 days, and then he rested. So it's part of the created order, and what's happening here is, God is, in a sense, calling Israel to Sinai and returning them back to the Garden of Eden. He calls them to Sinai, and he's in terms of the biblical story, he's returning them to Eden and to the joy of working and resting that they had in Eden. This is very, very rich. He's looking back to Eden before the fall, and he's saying, let's go back there to the goodness there. And so then this begs a question, what does the Sabbath command mean for 21st century Christians? Well, certainly in Christian tradition, it's rightly been interpreted in terms of pausing to worship. And I think that's helpful and important. But it also teaches us, the Sabbath command teaches us, that we Christians must not live in such a way that other people can't rest, or that the earth doesn't rest. It turns us to focus on the thriving of others, that we can have that rest that we were created to have, that thriving that we were created to have. And just now, to apply it before we go to the next command I want to go to, this series is particularly focused on reconciliation with an eye to residential schools. And as you know, we're moving in this series, just to locate us, towards September. And in September is what's called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And this comes to Vancouver. And it's a time when Indigenous survivors of residential schools will tell their story. And the whole denomination is in Canada, has a mandate to move towards that. And so in partnership with other local CRC churches, this is what we're doing. And this three sermon series is focusing on that. So the Sabbath command, the fourth command, and Indigenous settler relations and residential schools. I was really struck, since trying to learn about this as a new Canadian to be, if you like, I'm not a citizen yet, the repeated theme that comes up in the history, that these residential schools are established in order to kill the savage and save the child. It's a deliberate program of unculturation and reculturation. It's kill the savage and save the child, is said by prime ministers. And I was fascinated by this quote by Hayter Reed, one of the early officials. He says, every effort against anything calculated to keep fresh in the memories of the children habits and associations, which is one of the main objects of industrial education, to obliterate. So what he's saying there is, we're going to obliterate Indigenous culture in the minds of the children who come to our residential schools. And in light of the fourth command calls us to live in such a way that every person is able to thrive and have the rest that God has created them to. The Sabbath command calls us then, I think speaks into the residential school program, in that the residential school program didn't allow rest and pushed against rest and in a sense stole rest from these children. If we could just grab the next slide here. I went to the Mission Residential School 3 weeks ago. It's called Samari Immaculate Residential School. And I took some photos there. I was allowed to. And I asked the caretaker if I could show them in church. And he said I could. And this is a picture of the dormitory where 30 boys slept in Mission there. And that's where they spent their life, right, from when they were 5 to when they were 17, 18, perhaps even 4 to 17 and 18. And it was very sobering to go to the residential school in Mission and to realize that this is local, this is part of our history, and man, this school closed in the mid-80s. I wasn't so young in the mid-80s, so I could have been at that school. And look, I want you to know that the priests that lived in the next room are on trial for child sexual assault at the moment. This is very, very... So the fourth command speaks that we would live in such a way that every person thrives. And in Canadian history, residential schools has been quite the opposite. Well, let's go on to the next command now, which is thou shalt not murder. And we'll try and get our head around this one. Thou shalt not murder, traditionally, and the way I suppose understood it in my younger days, was that it's been applied individualistically. Thou shalt not murder. And what it means is you shan't be a person who kills someone else, and murderers are criminals, and that's the way the sixth commandment has been applied. Sometimes the sixth commandment, it seems to me, has been applied to society in these ways. Thou shalt not murder has been applied to capital punishment. Can a society kill a criminal who's murdered someone else? Is capital punishment right? Another way thou shalt not murder has been applied has been in terms perhaps of war. Is it right to fight a war? Thou shalt not murder. But what's interesting, as the rest of the Old Testament makes clear, that thou shalt not murder is spoken mostly to restrain the excesses of powerful people like Pharaoh. And you see that, for example, if you want to check me on this, I'd invite you to, say, read at home Isaiah chapter 58 and 59. Because the original context of these words, once again, is slavery in Egypt. And here we are at Sinai, if you can picture it, hearing these words, thou shalt not murder. And what beautiful words to give this nation of bereaved slaves. Just think of what's happened in Egypt. Foremen are beaten to death. A generation of male children, babies killed. Thou shalt not murder. Human life is valued. And if you just want to flick back to Genesis now, if you would with me in your Bible, back to Genesis 9, and we'll see how this law that values human life is grounded in the Old Testament. And if you just flick quickly to Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, right at the beginning of the Bible, and where it is grounded, one way it's grounded is that humankind is created in the image of God. Genesis 9, 6. Whoever sheds the blood of humankind, by humankind their blood shall be shed. For God made humankind in his own image. So the point is, because God made humankind in his own image, thou shalt not murder. The value of human life is grounded in our image bearing, bearing the image of God. And the way that this thou shalt not murder command is unfolded in the Bible is very interesting. First of all, in the Old Testament, it's unfolded like this, that we are to live in such a way, not just that we don't kill people, but in such a way that every person can thrive. And if you have quick fingers, you might like to turn to Deuteronomy 24:6, where it says, don't take a millstone in pledge, for that would be taking a life in pledge. The millstone that we grind our wheat with, you can't take that if someone's in debt to you, because that's like taking their life away. That's how they eat wheat. That's how they make bread. So thou shalt not murder means we have to live in such a way that people can thrive, not just that you can't kill people. And further, as we saw last week from Matthew chapter 5 and the Beatitudes, we looked at that command and the way that that was worked out in Jesus' teaching. And Jesus said, Matthew chapter 5, verse 21, you've heard it said of old, thou shalt not murder. And then he says, but I say to you, don't be angry at your brother or sister. And then he says in verse 24, Matthew chapter 5, 24, be reconciled to your brother and sister. So that thou shalt not murder becomes a call to be reconciled and to move towards the other. And it even has to do with emotions. And we said last week that this is very relevant for Indigenous settler relations and residential schools, because there's a rupture in the relationship between the church and the Indigenous community in light of residential schools, to some degree, despite the grace of the Indigenous community, or notwithstanding the grace of the Indigenous community. And there's certainly a rupture in the relationship between the church and Canadian society, because our reputation and Christ's reputation is caught up with this history. And so thou shalt not murder then is a call to live so that every person can thrive, and also a call to reconciliation. Can you see the richness and the depth of these Ten Commandments? What I'd like to do now is just to pause for just for 5 minutes. And as a way of applying these Ten Commandments, and I just have one more to talk about, which is thou shalt not steal, I'd like just to watch the opening 5 minutes of a very important movie, We Were Children. We Were Children is an Indigenous-produced movie, and it's about residential schools. And just to tell you what happens in this movie, it's a biography of a man and a woman, a boy and a girl. And in the movie, we're constantly cutting between two young actors who are acting out the lives of these man and woman, and then the actual man and woman as a senior talking about what happened in their residential school. And in this first 5 minutes, it's just the beginning of the story of this young girl who's 5 years old. I find this kind of stuff very disturbing to encounter, so I just want to tell you that there's no physical or sexual abuse in this 5 minutes, just so that you know that. This is just the very beginning. She doesn't get far past the family farm in this. But I found this very useful for myself to watch, because it just reminds me that this is real, that these are people just like me, and this is a family just like mine. So this is the very beginning of the movie, We Were Children, and it's available free online if you Google it to see the whole thing. The school in Mission that I visited 2 weeks ago, an elder spoke who was a survivor of residential schools, and she started her one-hour address just by saying emphatically, it's an abuse to forcibly remove children from their families. And as a young father, I felt the force of that. She went on to describe the sexual abuse she'd experienced. But you didn't have to go there to find abuse. It's an abuse to take kids away. As the movie unfolds, girl is abused in her first year of being at the school. well, I want to make sure that this series is heavily expository and deeply embedded in the text. So I want to persevere and just unfold one more command, and perhaps the most important in regards to the theme at hand, which is you shall not steal. So let me try and explain this theme. Thou shalt not steal. For most of my life, when I thought of the command, thou shalt not steal, my mind and imagination would go to the petty thief. I don't know about in Canada, but in Australia, there's that image of Hamburglar from McDonald's. And Hamburglar in Australia has black and white stripes and a black mask. And you know exactly what he's up to. He's up to mischief. He's climbing through windows and stealing things. And when I read, thou shalt not steal, my mind would go to Hamburglar, the petty thief. And what's interesting is that from the rest of the Old Testament, we know that the focus of this eighth command, thou shalt not steal, it doesn't disclude that, but that's not the focus. The focus of thou shalt not steal, and this is very, very significant, listen to this, is to restrain the rich. The focus of thou shalt not steal is to restrain the rich. Now let me explain that. The main protection against poverty in Israel was land laws. Every Israelite family was to own land suitable for grazing and agriculture. Now you remember the book of Joshua, right? The land is taken and every Israelite family gets given a farm. And the point is that if you're each family given a plot of land, you can't get rid of it. You can't give it away. You can't take it from someone. You can't even sell it. The land is, sometimes it's said, inalienable. It's stuck with the family forever. And if you have quick fingers, you can turn to Leviticus 25, 23, which says this: the land must not be sold permanently because the land is mine. And so, it means that, can you see how remarkable this is? Because it means that no Israelite family can permanently fall into poverty. Because everyone's got land. And it also means, so that's one side of it, no Israelite family can permanently fall into poverty because everyone's got land, everyone's got a farm. The other side to it is, no Israelite family can get excessively rich because all you can have is your own farm. It's an extraordinary economic arrangement. Extraordinary. And so Craig Blomberg, an evangelical scholar, has summarized this in this way: God owns it all and wants everybody to be able to enjoy some of it. God owns it all and wants everybody to be able to enjoy some of it. And I think, as a Christian in 2013, when the church and the Bible gets a whole lot of bad press, that this is something to celebrate and to display to the world. This pattern of biblical ethics. That God owns it all and he wants everybody to be able to enjoy some of it. And again, it turns our attention, we just cast a light on land and indigenous settler relationships. And in part of our history in Canada is these treaties. And Professor Ray Aldred, who's coming here on Saturday at 9 a.m., he said to us in Vancouver a few months ago when I heard him that the treaties were attractive to indigenous people because in indigenous thought, the Creator made everything and all people have the right to live on the land. And you can see how Janessa was speaking about indigenous Christians making connection between their traditional worldview and Christian ethics. And there's a connection there in terms of an understanding of the land being given for all. And Ray Aldred shared, and he'll probably speak about this on Saturday again, of Treaty 4, one of the treaties on the prairies, represented by a three-strand grass. One strand represents the newcomers, Ray said. One strand represents the indigenous people, and one strand represents the Creator. And so he said, in indigenous thought, the people in the prairies were to be like family. But in colonial thought, there was this expanding desire for land. And we can't afford to buy the land, so we make treaties and pay annual annuities. But that becomes too expensive, so we move beyond treaties. And often the land is simply taken. And so, of course, here in Langley, it's Stolo land, but it's non-treated. The land was just taken. And Ray Aldred spoke about it, and he'll probably speak about Saturday, the Rupert Land Transfer, which is the Hudson Bay, that all the water that drains into the Hudson Bay belongs to the Hudson Bay Company by legislation. The government declares that all the water, all the area around Hudson Bay, I mean, there's a huge area, belongs to the Hudson Bay Company for fur. And then in 1870, the Hudson Bay Company sold it to the government because the Hudson Bay Company was pulling out because it wasn't profitable. And the indigenous people thought, what? God owns it all, and he wants everyone to be able to enjoy some of it. And that there are connections there, I was pointing out, between the Bible and indigenous thought. Three commands. So the point I want to make, I think, today is this. That our history regarding settler-indigenous relations, our history regarding residential schools, it is an abrogation of the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments have not been kept. The Ten Commandments have a central place in Reformed thought, a central place in Christian tradition. And when we look at indigenous settler relations, the Ten Commandments have been broken. That's my point. And that's very significant. And here, over the last couple of months, CRC pastors from Vancouver have been meeting up, and we've been saying, so what do we do? What's our application from looking at the Ten Commandments today? And we've been throwing that around. And then Andrew Bianc from New West CRC, he said, you know, we don't have the knowledge, and we would be foolish to try and start some program or try and start some new initiative. He said, we have to listen. And all the pastors around said, that's right. We have to listen. And this is exactly why we organized this day on Saturday of combined CRC churches, a day of listening. And Ray Aldred, he's an evangelical, even reformed, senior indigenous scholar from Ambrose University. We're flying him out here. He has relations here. And he's going to come out and he's going to address us on Saturday. And the welcome to land will be given by Patty Wilson, who is the indigenous dean, indigenous chaplain. Janessa, help me out. The elder on campus at Trinity Western. And she is going to do a welcome to land, I think, with her family, who are going to welcome us with drums, which is going to be wonderful. It's a real privilege. And this is, I just want to say, that what's happening here on Saturday is very unique. It's very unique to have a partnership between CRC churches like this. And I've been speaking to Indigenous people who are generous enough to join us on this day, and they have said, we're really excited about this. And I think that's such grace to say they're excited. But that just the theme that keeps coming from Indigenous people, the Indigenous communities we speak to them, is we want relationship with you. And we're thrilled that you're talking about this. And we want relationship. And when I went to this mission school, St. Mary the Immaculate, there were two Indigenous elders who were survivors of residential school. And do you know what they did? They stood us around in a circle and they got us to hold hands. And we held hands for about 5 minutes. And this is what they did just naturally. But what they were communicating to us is, we want relationship. And we're thrilled you're here. And so I want to say that I think this is a very, very significant and almost unique opportunity on Australia between 9 and 4. And for parents, I think for Erin and I think to learn about this stuff and to hear about this stuff from Indigenous people themselves, this is something we want to do so that we can nurture our kids to be faithful Christians in Canada. And I think for teenagers, it'd be wonderful if you could come, teenagers, so that you can be faithful as a Christian in Canada regarding these things. And to our seniors here, I want to encourage you to come, and perhaps all your life, you've lived through this history. This history of residential schools is part of your story as well. And perhaps by coming, you can do some serious processing. I think that this is a really unique opportunity. And you know, all the pastors are coming. If on Saturday you want to catch up with Tom Bomhoff and have coffee with him, or if you want to hook up with Jody Bomhoff, you won't be able to have coffee with Tom unless you're here. And if on Saturday you want to, Audrey, if you want to catch up with Nathan Elgesma, your brother, you won't be able to unless you come here. Because the pastor's going to be here. Because we want to come here as a gesture of humility, as Andrew Bionk said, to listen. And all of us pastors, we're talking about this and we're saying this is so important. And our ultimate goal, our dream, is that when we come to September, this Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that 50 people from all of our churches, a few hundred from all our CRC churches, would go to Vancouver and sit there and listen to these stories. Now, Josh DeGroot shared with me, I'm sure you won't mind me sharing, Josh, that he was there on Vancouver Island when the commission was there. And an old man told his story of being in a residential school. And Josh said, that story was enough. Then he went outside and he walked around and he processed it. This is huge stuff. This is stuff right at the heart of the Canadian story. And Matthew chapter 5, Christ says, be reconciled to your brother and sister. And the Indigenous community is telling us, what we want you to do is to listen. And so I would ask, humbly, if you'd be kind enough, teenagers, young adults, seniors, everyone in between, to come and listen on Saturday. Aaron's been kind enough to be a part of organising some childcare. We're going to do it on rotation so that parents can come. So parents, bring your kids and we'll rotate through. Parents will rotate and take it in turns to mind children. Guys, if you'd be kind enough, if you're not a parent, if you want to help with this rotation and minding kids, would you please just email Steph or I at the office, and that way we can get some help in minding these children on rotation. So I'm really excited. I feel it's a real privilege. Ray Aldred is a reformed man and a gentle man, and you'll find him very winsome. And it'll change your life if you come Saturday. Thanks.